Welcome to the LSE Events Podcast by the London School of Economics and Political Science. Get ready to hear from some of the most influential international figures in the social sciences.
Hi, good evening, everyone. Welcome to the LSE. Welcome to this hybrid event. My name's Professor Coretta Phillips, and I'm a Professor of Criminology and Social Policy here at the LSE. So pleased to welcome our panel, and to all of you, it's great to have such a large audience. And so the event's entitled Mass Media, Justice and Me, A Victim's Perspective. It's been organised by the LSE Law School. I'd like to thank in advance our online audience and all of you for joining us today. It's fantastic to see so many of you. Before I introduce our panellists more fully, there are just a few housekeeping matters to attend to. Most obviously, if there's a fire alarm, then we exit the building through the staircase and we attend the fire assembly point, which is opposite this building on the corner of Lincoln's Inn Fields. A reminder that the event is being recorded. It will be made available as a podcast, subject to there being no technical difficulties. At this point, please, can I ask everyone to turn their mobile phones off or onto silent, please, so that the event isn't disrupted. Before I go to introduce our panellists, I would like to thank the LSE Law School events organisers, particularly Beth Glover and Kat. Apologies, I don't know your surname. But to thank you for ensuring that all of the logistics have happened. These kinds of events take lots of organisation behind the scenes, so thank you to the LSE Law School events team. Let me just say something about tonight's format before I then turn to our guests. So we'll be beginning with a short four-minute video which captures some of the essence and the themes of this evening's events. And it will be depicting the good, the bad and the ugly of media relationships with victims. We'll then hear from our panel members who have been asked to talk for 5 to 7 minutes or so. So I might be waving yellow post-its at them at some point. But I suspect, given the topic, there's really so much that can be said. And so I'm sure we'll all be patient and excited to hear from our panelists. And hopefully there will also be enough time to hear questions and comments from you too. Okay, so first of all, Joe Hamilton, OBE, welcome, is a former sub-postmaster and ardent campaigner for victims of the British Post Office scandal that was depicted so well in the TV series that many of us will have watched. Joe was named by the Independent newspaper as one of the 50th most influential women in 2024. Welcome also to Martin Hibbert at the end, a survivor of the horrific Manchester Arena bomb in 2017. He's vice president of the Spinal Injuries Association and a motivational speaker and activist. Welcome also to Janet Street Porter, probably needs little introduction as she's very famous. Writer, broadcaster and former editor of The Independent on Sunday, Janet's won numerous awards, including Columnist of the Year and the Prix Italia for Arts, Programming and a BAFTA for Originality. Welcome also to Neil Hudgell, the founder and executive chairman of Hudgell Solicitors. He'll be talking about the impact of the media on legal cases. We also have Olivia O'Kane, a partner at the legal firm Lewis Silkin, and she will be focusing her comments on internet liability and human rights protections. And then finally, to our guest, a host, I think, also, Nicola Lacey, CBE, who's School Professor of Law, Gender and Social Policy here at LSE. And she'll be addressing the place of the law and the challenge given victims' position in our adversarial criminal justice system. So, as I said, I'm hoping that people will be speaking for around 7 minutes or so there'll be plenty of time for questions and also your thoughts. Okay, so let's begin first of all. So we'll move now to our panellists and then I'll come back with some instructions about questions at the end. Joe, first of all, I think you'll be able to talk us through some of the good and the bad and perhaps less of the ugly.
Yeah, well, I guess I'm lucky that mine all began before the days of social media, because I'm sure I would have been splattered all over social media as being a thief and a fraudster. But fortunately, back in the day, only the local papers got hold of it. And I was put all over the front of it as being a fraudster, which I guess technically they were right, because I'd gone to court and pleaded guilty to false accounting. But because my lovely village all turned up to support me, it was re-reported, even though they asked me for an interview and I couldn't give them an interview because I was on probation. They made it up anyway out of what they'd gleaned from the local papers, and I then was splattered in the Mail and the Express, which at the time was devastating because my mum read the Mail and she said to me, "Oh my God, look, you're in the paper," and then it was like, "Oh God, the whole world's gonna know." But yeah, fortunately, it was before the days of social media, because I dread to think what would have happened then. But it turned out to be a good thing that I ended up in the national papers, because Alan Bates phoned me, and Computer Weekly phoned me, and the lovely guy over there, Carl Flinders, has done something like 600 articles ever since he's doggedly reported. Because I ended up with national attention, the media then realised we could use them to gather people, and people phoned me and said that it had happened to them, and we gradually built a network of people that it had happened to. Computer Weekly published an article which they were under threat of being sued by the post office for, but it took about 7 months of wrangling and then it was produced, and the whole campaign then got a little bit of traction and we all met up. And I can honestly say from then on, even though we've made panoramas and Carl's reported in Computer Weekly, it was slow. It really was slow, but we never gave up and we kept fighting. And we, even though we had two massive High Court victories, unfortunately Brexit was going on at the time of the first trial, and then Boris Johnson got elected on the day we won the second trial. So instead of being a magnificent victory splattered all over the front of the papers, Boris was instead. So we kind of went on the back foot again. Then we crept up again. Hudgels got hold of us and got our convictions overturned, and we made it onto the front of some papers then. But nothing had the power that the drama, when the ITV drama was made, it literally turned the whole thing round. And the government, who'd been hiding from us, and they'd managed it, they were so relieved it had kept out of the press, really. They couldn't hide anymore, and I honestly can't thank the people that made the drama enough. I think people now, as a result of the drama, have become more aware about things that go on that we actually don't know about. And I think the media, if they could turn their attention to good and not bad, look at what could happen, because they changed legislation and everything as a result of the drama. They realise, you know, everyone's really angry, and I'm sure there's loads of Mr. Bates stories in there about everything else. We saw a bit of the dirty water the other day, but I just beg anyone to get behind it and use the media to good effect, because it's so powerful when it's used the right way, but it's not very nice when it isn't.
Thank you. Thank you. Martin, if you'd like to...
Hi, good evening, yes. Everyone. My name's Martin Hibbert, and as I said in the video, myself and my daughter Eve, who was 14 at the time, we were 6 metres away from Salman Abedi when he detonated his suicide bomb in the city room. And obviously went to the local hospital, which was Salford Royal, Thankfully, I was in intensive care, so I don't have a lot to remember from that time, but I remember my wife suffered a lot at the hands of the media. As I said in the video, we had journalists trying to get into our rooms, pretending to be doctors and nurses. They were waiting at Eve's school, pretending to be parents. They were trying to contact friends through LinkedIn and Facebook, just trying to get the story. And it got to the point, especially in hospital, when certainly over the first couple of days, when it didn't look like it, myself and Eve were going to survive. We ended up having to be put into private rooms with passcodes because people were trying to get into our rooms. So my wife, Gabby, says at the time that, you know, she was obviously, you know, thinking of better things, but what she was having to do was put names onto spreadsheets and give passcodes for friends and family that were wanting to visit at the time. So it was obviously, you know, we'd been through a big traumatic event, so to have and to have to deal with that at the same time as well. You know, now my mum passed in 21, I hate to think that, you know, they were put through that. So we certainly saw the bad and the ugly. And then it wasn't until a few months later, once I was getting better and I'd been transferred from Salford Royal to the Spinal Unit, which was in Southport, and my form was going crazy. I had journalists from all over trying to contact us. And I just remember thinking, I want to keep Eve out of the media. She'd started to get better and it looked like she was going to survive. So I just remember thinking, look, if I put myself in front of the camera and give them the story, then it'll take the limelight away from Eve. And then over time, I started doing, you know, various shows. I went on various breakfast shows. And in the end, I actually turned the media onto my side. And then in 2022... I became the second wheelchair user to summit Kilimanjaro. I raised £1 million, and the media were a big help to that. And then during that time is when the conspiracy theorist Richard D. Hall decided to make it personal, decided to go after Eve, and decided he thought it was a good idea to get in his car and video, or try and video Eve outside the house, because he didn't think that Eve had been... He didn't think she was my daughter. He didn't think that we had been injured in the arena attack. He thought it was a government hoax. And he decided to make it personal and bring Eve into it. And that's when, for me, Richard crossed the line. In 2024, we took Richard to the High Court and we won a landmark case. Sadly, it's still ongoing. He's appealed. He's exhausted all his UK opportunities now. And on the 8th of May, he's got a bankruptcy hearing in Cardiff. So hopefully, in May, that'll be the end of it. But I've seen, certainly over the last, 9 years, I've seen the good, the bad and the ugly of the media. But hopefully now I've turned it around. And as I said in the video, I've used it to good use and use it now for raising awareness about spinal cord injuries and hopefully trying to make the world a better place for disabled people.
Thank you, Janet. Over to you.
I'm sitting on this panel and I'm not entirely sure in what capacity, whether to represent all the ghastly newspaper and the media, or also to just talk a little bit about what it's like when to be pursued by the press. So I've been in the invidious position of as a schoolgirl, and then, you know, a student always wanting to be a writer, and then starting off paradoxically on a magazine for about 6 months, and then at the age of 21 getting a job on the Daily Mail, who really promoted me. But, of course, although I was a journalist, I then made the fatal mistake of going onto the radio and appearing as myself with a London accent in London. And so it was about the first commercial radio station, LBC. And so I was vilified. I was vilified, and that was way before social media. So when people talk about trolling and attacking now, I was suddenly attacked by all the people I'd just been working with. I found it utterly confusing, and it was basically two things. It was a class thing, because I carried that working class accent. It was also a sex thing, because suddenly it was a woman who had 3 hours of radio time 5 days a week. So I was in the unexpected position of being pilloried, and then I was pilloried by impersonators and so on. But all that happened to me, nothing that happened to me is as ghastly as the two stories you just heard before. But what it gave me was an ultra thick skin. So now nobody could upset me. They could say what the fuck they like. It would not make any difference. And in fact, I do a one-woman show, and I show all the shitty pictures and all the headlines that I go. So who's standing here earning money? Those people that wrote it. They're anonymous twats. And I think it's important to have a sense of proportion, because as the oldest person on the panel, and I'm starting my journalistic career at 21, I've seen it through so many changes, because obviously I ended up as a newspaper editor creating a newspaper on computers, where I started writing as a newspaper columnist and fashion editor for the Daily Mail. Everything was made in hot metal. And then, of course, along came Facebook and the internet and social media. When I was a newspaper editor, that didn't really exist. So our criteria for stories that we took, you might say, an unhealthy interest in, were largely to do with imagery and family backgrounds. And so if you look back at the Soham murders, for example, that's a prime example of a case that the whole nation was utterly gripped by, because Holly and Jessica were two little 10-year-old girls wearing red Manchester United shirts, and that picture was made available to the press, and it dominated the media, just as the picture of Myra Hindley had done decades before, the image of Myra Hindley looking, you know, shocking. And then if we move on to the McCann case and Madeleine McCann, there a little girl goes missing, and she has an extraordinary face with different coloured eyes, and the picture goes around the world. So now in the modern media, imagery is part of it too. What I find now quite interesting is the notion of anonymity and privacy people are still desperately clinging to. I think you can give up on that. Really, really do. I think it's impossible to be anonymous in a society where everybody has a phone or a way of recording you. I find it quite comical that some people are still objecting to ID cards. I mean, why are you bothering to object? You're already identified everywhere you go anyway. You're already tracked. Sometimes I feel as if I'm tagged. People say to me, or they put online, I saw Janet, and they'll give my exact location online. And so, in a way, the minute that you become well-known, everybody knows a lot more about you, and you could never put that back in the box. So that's a situation that no amount of legislation or privacy laws, in my humble opinion, can do a lot about. I think the worst development in terms of uncontrolled press is not newspapers, as we know, print journalism is dying a slow death, but the new kids on the block, the TikTokers and the true crime YouTubers, that's the Wild West. So the mainstream press, if you like, has been legislated. There's been the Leveson inquiry. There's been all sorts of court cases. I think they are, by and large, a lot better behaved than they were. I'm not sticking up for the tabloids. I never could, because they've written terrible shit about me as well and but I've never bothered to sue for libel because I think it's a waste of time. But I think by and large, the press behave slightly better now than they did 20 years ago. But you can't say that about the people who go to the site of missing, like the Nicola Bulley case and the Jay Slater case. If you take those two stories, for example, as we heard, when Nicola Bulley went missing, every kid in the south of England had to hedge to where they thought she might be. They had to come up with spurious theories. They had to stand where they thought she might have fallen in the river. It was just horrific. It was totally out of control. When Jay Slater disappeared in Tenerife, exactly the same thing happened. Now, who's to blame for all of this? Well, you could say the streaming networks. They have whole channels now of true crime. And I'm astonished. And it's particularly popular with women. So it's a genre that's absolutely exploding. Every night of the week, you can see some horrific murder case dissected in intimate detail. And at the same time, there are whole channels on YouTube doing exactly the same thing. So I don't really know how an online safety, the Online Safety Act, any new provisions, what it can do about it, because I think you have to accept things have gone so far that it's hard to put the everything back in the box. I mean, I would like to see, you can't copyright yourself. That's the other thing. You can't trademark yourself. I just don't see what we can do to stop people coming and standing outside your house, revealing where you live. I just don't see how that can be stopped now. And I think it's a pretty poor state of affairs. That's all I've got to say.
Thank you. So a helpful segue into talking about the legality or the legal position in relation.
Yeah, it's a really helpful segue, and obviously we've had the F-bomb, so the pressure's off me. Looks like a damn sight easier. I just was obviously watching the video, listening to you all here and looking at the title about justice and victims. And my overarching thought on this is that the media are more and more pivotal to victims getting justice. And I say that because we have so many instances where the state and the bodies associated with the state are systematically letting victims down, whether that be through cover-up or incompetence or just a basic lack of any desire to get to the truth. I'm not sure, but very certainly my broad experience is, and I've only speak for 5 or 7 minutes, so it has to be quite generalised, is that the media can be a very positive force for good. I think where those lawyers come in, very often there's damage already done to the clients and the victims and the families, and that's essentially because, and this is one of the things I sort of recognised quite early on in my engagement with the media, is you've got to understand what their job is. And there's a mad rush to get the exclusive. And unfortunately, the likes of you are collateral damage in that indecent haste to get somewhere quickly and get that headline. And it's our job, when we engage, is to sell this idea that the media have a job to do, but they can do it in a respectful way. And if we collaborate with them, we can get what we want. And what we want are, in everyone's cases, such as yours, is answers and accountability. And the surest way to get people to act is to play that out in the front pages of the newspaper and on the television reels. And I think we've all got tangible examples of that. So you know, Martin, you said when you spoke about you turn the media around and you know how to play them. But forgive me if I've got this wrong. But there was a time when you know, in the months in the aftermath of the atrocity, that you're laid there and there's this thing ticking in your mind. I'm on the floor of the arena for over an hour. No one comes to me. The authorities are reporting, you know, fantastic reaction. We've done all we can. And you're not getting answers. You're approaching the Greater Manchester Police. Can I have details of other people that were in the arena? No, you can't have them. And you went to the television who'd ran an early story on it, provided some details to you. And then on the back of that, you start to speak to people. You start to grow a collective. You start to get the media attention. People then start to ask the questions. John Saunders is then encouraged to convert an inquest to a public inquiry with all the necessary teeth. He produces three reports that all are very damning of the reaction, the response to the... in very many ways. But the sort of seeds of that, in some respects, came from the media. Most of it came from you, because you've got a determination to get answers for stuff. The people I'm more worried about, in some senses, are those that don't have that drive, don't have that get up and go, and never get off base one. And I think you also, more recently, with Hall, we've seen the damage. The other side of the coin, to see the damage that can be done by this alternative media that actually, again, in some respects is born of a sort of casual thought that I can say what I like online. It doesn't have the same consequence, but in actual fact it can be worse, and you can measure that because you can see how many likes, how many retweets, and what have you. And it's something you couldn't ignore either, because what's really quite worrying is the number of people that buy into the absurdity of the conspiracy theorist. And again, the mainstream media were very, very responsible about how they conveyed and carried this. And again, through, you know, from your good judgment and perseverance on that, we obviously secured a landmark ruling. But again, that demonstrates some of the frustrations with the justice system, with nearly 2.5 years on from that judgment, and there's still legalities and wranglings going on. So I think that my broad perspective on it all is, if we can work with the media, and the media love people and they love stories, and that we can get the stories out there. One of the successes of Post Office was to get human impact into the media, and people were like, that could have been me. I could have been in that post office, pillar of the community, running up against this big state organisation, and I could have been powerless at the same time. And I think once you can get that and get that front of voice, it starts to become an irresistible proposition. But I've dozens of examples of where that has happened. We've got a public inquiry that's ongoing at the moment, where day on day, the mainstream media are responsibly reporting failing after failing after failing, and that's on the national profile, and therefore it's very hard for people to hide from, and it's a big step on the way to justice and accountability.
Thank you. And Olivia, continuing our usual reflections. Thank you.
Yes, thank you, Martin, Joe, Janet, Neil, Nikki and Coretta. I've been asked to summarise the legal framework. As I see it, the relationship between press reporting and political action is complex, and often frustrating for those who seek accountability. As Lord Bingham remarked, modern democratic government means government of the people, by the people, for the people. But if they are ignorant of the issues to be resolved, the arguments for and against, and the facts underlying those arguments, there can be no assurance that government is carried out for the people, unless the facts are made known and the issues are publicly ventilated. An unfettered and independent press is essential in freedom of expression, a fundamental and basic human right. It has been observed that a free press is not a luxury. If there is no searchlight on corruption and inequitable practices, you cannot build that public consensus needed to bring about change. So without the sustained public pressure, legislative and regulatory change tends to stall or reverse. For two decades, investigative journalists and campaigners like Joe and legal professionals like Neil sought to expose the miscarriage of justice and injustice suffered by the sub-postmasters. Yet the story failed to generate the public outrage necessary to compel action. But the foundation for change was paved through decades of investigative journalism, campaigning and whistleblowers. And a critical turning point did come with the ITV drama. Its emotional power made millions of viewers feel the injustice, not merely know about it. Over 14 million viewers, many who would never engage with news coverage or campaigning organisations. Complex technical issues, the flawed Horizon IT system, the legal proceedings, the institutional failures were distilled into a human story of ordinary people fighting an unjust system. The public at that point, though, had grown accustomed to the scandal being reported in the background of a news cycle, and the dramatisation reframed it as an urgent moral crisis demanding a response. So the drama did not appear or emerge in a vacuum. It amplified that factual record that journalists and campaigners had painstakingly assembled. So I argue that the drama underlines the indispensable role of investigative journalism to uncover the facts, hold power to account, and to provide the evidential foundation upon which public debate rests. Without those brave campaigners like Joe and others, without the whistleblowers, and without the 20 years of journalists gathering and testing the facts with rigour and defending the threatening injunctions, voices would never have been heard. Martin's case is a landmark on when freedom of expression crosses from legitimate reporting into unlawful harassment. Section 1 of the Protection of the Harassment Act prohibits a course of conduct amounting to harassment which he knows or ought to know amounts to harassment, which in turn means conduct targeted at an individual which is calculated to produce fear, distress, anxiety, and which is oppressive and unreasonable. The conduct must cross the boundary between conduct which is merely unattractive and instead amounts to conduct which is oppressive and unacceptable and of a gravity of an order which would sustain criminal liability. The legal framework is rooted in the competing tension, however, between two competing rights, and any claim of harassment by speech is likely to engage a defendant's right to freedom of expression. That right is protected by the common law and Article 10 of the European Convention of Human Rights, and where the conduct complained of consists largely of publication of journalistic material, that right assumes even greater importance. The foundational authority remains the decision in Thomas, which established that press criticism, even if robust, does not constitute harassment. And before press publications are capable of constituting harassment, they must be attended by some exceptional circumstance and is rare. The courts have distilled the principle further. Nothing short of a conscious or negligent abuse of media freedom will justify a finding of harassment of this type. The court must approach that assessment objectively and must not be swayed by the subjective feelings of a claimant, and bear in mind the techniques of reporting, including the tone and editorial decisions about content, all matters for the media and not for the court to determine. So the key principles that emerge out of the case law, the threshold is high and exceptional, as upheld in Thomas and by the Northern Ireland Court of Appeal in two cases I acted in, King and Fulton. Nothing short of a conscious or negligent abuse of media freedom justifies a finding of harassment. The conduct must be targeted at an individual causing alarm or distress, and vulnerability and personal characteristics are taken into account. Truth or falsity is not determinative, but where allegations are shown to be false, the freedom of expression and public interest value is less and a finding more likely. Physical intrusion heightens that conduct. Visiting a victim's home or surreptitious surveillance moves conduct beyond mere speech. This approach applies equally to citizen journalists. Though without that editorial oversight and lacking of regulatory structures, a court may find it harder to demonstrate a reasonableness of such conduct. So I've said that the court will robustly protect freedom of expression, including the freedom to investigate, question and challenge established narratives, but there are limits. It is a qualified right. The line is drawn at a conscious, negligent abuse of media freedom. The media landscape has changed dramatically with the rise of news influencers and alternative voices fragmenting traditional journalism. The courts have recognised freedom of speech as intrinsically important and instrumentally vital. It promotes individual self-fulfilment, serves as a marketplace for truth, is the lifeblood of democracy. But at its heart lies fundamental tensions of rights. On the one hand, everyone's right to freedom of expression, and on the other rights such as Article 8, right to privacy. The right to freedom of expression must be balanced against those other rights, and Article 8, right to privacy, results in a balancing where there is a conflict, and in order to achieve the outcome, there is an ultimate balancing test. Online, there is a legal and regulatory regime. As regards the legal framework, the law applies online as it does offline. Platform liability is largely a notice and takedown system, as platforms are not generally publishers in law unless it loses the safe harbour defence. Pursuant to the e-commerce regulations 2002, an information society service such as platforms and search engines are generally not liable for the user-generated content it hosts if they do not have actual knowledge of the illegal content. The platform is therefore not liable to pay damage until it has been put on actual notice of indisputably unlawful content that it hosts by the users who have published it. In that case, it must expeditiously remove access or take down that unlawful content. The safe harbour defence, if displaced, and there is a failure to comply with that notice and takedown regime, may mean in circumstances that the platform assumes liability as a secondary publisher, no longer innocently disseminating. And from a regulatory perspective, there is a patchwork of a framework, including the ICO for data protection compliance and the recent Online Safety Act, which places new duties on platforms in respect of online harm.
So our final speaker, Professor Nikki Lacey.
Thank you so much, Coretta. And can I just start by saying it's an incredible privilege and a humbling one to speak on a panel after three people who've gone through and endured not only deep injustice but a lot of suffering, and who've brought something so positive out of that terrible experience. I think it's really very extraordinary. And it's also very humbling to hear about the lawyers who've really worked in a practical way to improve the law and to draw attention socially to the very difficult issues that we're facing. I'm going to go speak briefly, and I'm just going to talk a little bit about where victims generally sit within our criminal process in particular. That happens to be my expertise. But I want to notice we've been talking and trying to bring out this evening the victim's perspective of some very different groups of victims, often, as in your case, Martin, overlapping. We've got victims of crime, victims of the criminal justice system, and victims of the media, and sometimes people can be all three. What each of those groups of victims shares is a very sort of precarious position as legal service users, and that is partly because of something that we all suffer from, and that is diminished access to justice in a world where the legal system, and particularly the public bits of the legal system, have been disinvested in over the last 15 years at least. So really none of it, very few of any of these groups have real access to the sorts of potentially really helpful legal services that we've heard about this evening in such a substantive way from Neil and Olivia. But I'm going to focus the rest of my comments on victims of crime, because that is an area in which, throughout the course of my embarrassingly long career, there has been a big movement and a big reform movement, a pressure for reform and actual real reforms, at least in the books. So victims of crime now benefit from a charter. There are organisations that are meant to defend their interests. But I want to draw attention, I'm really echoing a bit your scepticism here, Janet, but I think that within the English and Welsh, which is what it is, criminal justice system as it exists today, there are real limits on how far the victim's needs and voice can be accommodated without encroaching on equally important, as we know from what we've heard this evening, procedural rights and safeguards for defendants. The whole thing is designed and set up as basically an issue between the state and the defendant. And in that logic of our criminal justice system, the victim is simply a witness. Now, over the last 50 years, various things have been done to try to ensure that victims are at least informed, are at least treated with dignity, respect, consideration, and an open ear, and sometimes get to voice their experience through things like impact statements. But there is really not very much further one can go without, as I say, encroaching on the protections that are quite properly and importantly there and which don't always work for defendants. And I think it's really important to grasp that, because I think it implies that the way forward is somewhat different from the way the victims' movement has been going. And I'll say something about that in a moment. Before I do, I just want to also observe a sort of realpolitik here. It doesn't matter how much you put obligations on the police or prosecutors to, you know, attend to the needs of victims and informing victims and so on, they are never realistically going to be the priority of these services, because these services are set up to and incentivised to and indeed obligated to put their priorities elsewhere. So personally, and this is where I'm going to sort of start to conclude, I've argued in my own work that we should not be thinking in terms of sort of providing for victims of crime, at least, around the edges of the criminal process, which wasn't designed for them except in a very indirect way, and which is frankly never going to put them where they need to be if they're to be properly cared for and assisted and supported in dealing with whatever experience of criminal victimisation they have. What we need is actually a completely independent set of services for victims which operates with different personnel. And I know that sounds like a completely unrealistic thing in a world in which we can't even pay for enough courts. But I think that is the way to go. And I think that although we've seen a sort of progress in some ways in the profile of criminal victimisation experience, and indeed perhaps of the experience of victimisation more generally in our society as a sort of cultural matter, and that perhaps that's why we have seen at least some improvement in the way the media have worked and operate, the public, the sort of official media. I think it's important we recognise there are limits, and there's a really a very long way to go.
So I really salute the work that all of you have done in different ways on this.
Thank you to our panellists and all for staying on time, which is, you can tell that it was a mixture of non-academics, because academics can never be held to time. But now we have plenty of time for questions and comments from our audience. So our stewards have roving mics that will come round the auditorium. We'll also take some questions from our online audience shortly, but let's start with people that are here in the room. So please can I ask that you indicate your name and affiliation. So let's start with the person in the stripy jumper on your right. If you can just wait for the mic and just please introduce yourself and then who you'd like your question to be directed to, or whether it's for the whole panel.
Hello, thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to speak. But I'm not much familiar with public speaking, so it will be only my question. First of all, I have come here very much as a distressed person, because we are victims of police misconduct. So I do not know that whether it is the appropriate place, because I can see that that here mass media is the issue. But both myself and my wife, we are two victims of massive police misconduct, and we have attempted all, and we have tried all the avenues available, called the complaint procedure to the police and to the justice system and the solicitors, but they all have failed. And the thing is that even because the police they committed massive data breach. Because they violated my wife's privacy, and they created massive, highly defamatory, false personal information on the police system, and then they spread to many third parties, and even to the neighbor, and they attacked my wife again and again, four times, and as a result, my wife suffered very much. And when you reported to the police, they dismissed all the claims. They dismissed all these crimes as anything that no further action. So could my wife was left alone.
Could I ask for you, perhaps, if we could ask the panelists to respond to your comments?
Right. So my comment is that how to proceed, because I have written to the government, there is silence. How I can pressurize the government, how I can create an awareness so that the public become aware of this police misconduct. So how I can create the awareness, or how I can force the government to consider our case. Because you have similar situation, so how did you create such an awareness, or how did you pressurize
the Thank government? You for your question. Yes. So if I could ask the... I don't know if it would be helpful to have a legal response in relation to the privacy element.
The criminal justice system is undoubtedly a complex system to navigate, and Nikki very helpfully highlighted one of the issues with the fact that victims are indeed witnesses and not a party in the proceedings. I hope that I was able to identify that there are a number of avenues, whether it be the criminal justice system or the civil proceedings or the regulatory perspective. So really looking at all of those options to exhaust whether or not you can exercise your rights through those routes, there are a lot of different regulatory bodies that are applicable. We have heard the ICO only at the end of February find a platform, Reddit, in multiple millions of pounds for not protecting children's personal data. So there are a wide variety of different avenues, and sometimes the regulatory path is oftentimes the swiftest and perhaps the easier to navigate.
Thank you.
That's fine. If you've covered it, I mean, okay, it sounds incredibly complex, so it might be a conversation to take offline.
Thank you. Other questions? So, somebody at the front in the blue top. You can say who you are.
Thank you. Yes, hello. I'm Martin Garthwaite. I'm a graduate of the school. I came here in 2004 to read a master's in media and communications and information systems. So my question is really for Joe, because I came here because my mother refused to use a computer, and I work in IT, so it drove me nuts. And when I first heard about the post office scandal, as an IT guy, it was obvious to me that the system was faulty, and it wasn't you guys. How frustrating was that for you? Because I remember seeing the ITV document where you were pressing the button and it was doubling.
Yeah. Well, I wasn't an IT person at all, and I have no idea. I always thought it was me because they told me it was me. And it wasn't until people started phoning the shop after I'd been sentenced, because of the media coverage, I had no idea that it wasn't all my fault, because I just thought it was me. And so it's so easy. I mean, we're going back to 2003 when that discrepancy you saw that Monica played out on the television. It was then, and it was chip and pin, and I thought this thing had been installed and it was going to revolutionise the accounting and it was all going to be easy. But what I didn't realise, there was no paper trail, so I actually couldn't prove anything. But they gaslit me for a couple of years, telling me it was all my fault. So, yeah.
Thank you for your question. So, someone in the middle here, and then we'll take one more and then go online to our online audience.
Thanks ever so much for your time this evening, everyone. My name's Emily. I'm a member of the public and I currently work for a trade union. My question is particularly towards the victims, but please do chip in across. And it's about pace and speed and your experience of experiencing a case where the legal proceedings are drawn out and take months, if not years, also stories hitting the press, whereas with the rise of social media and online publications, things can happen in a matter of minutes, hours, overnight. So yeah, any comment please about that utter contrast in pace between years of your life and things going public in a matter of seconds. Thank you.
Once I was sacked, it was 2 years to get me to Crown Court and to be sentenced. And then it took another 5 years to get we'd had the mediation scheme, which was set up with the MP's involvement. The post office sacked the mediation. The guys set out to investigate it. They sacked them. And then we applied in 2016 for a group litigation order, which took a year. And then we were in court first off in 2017. And then eventually we won at the end of 2019. And then we had another 2 year battle to overturn my conviction. So basically it took a very long time. But then the drama hit, and all of a sudden MPs were literally jumping through hoops, couldn't do enough for us.
I think with the two cases that I've been involved with, the Arena case, obviously has only really just concluded in January, where you know the settlements have been paid. You know that's been a tough one, and you know some of my legal team are here that have been with me through that, and that's been frustrating, and obviously there was a lot of. You know, in terms of Salman's brother who had to be extradited and things like that, and then we had to go through an inquiry and a trial. So that was frustrating. But I think, you know, and I think, you know, Neil might want to jump in on this, but I think certainly me putting the survivors group together, I do wonder, you know, where we would be and if we'd have got what we had, had I not done. And I think, you know, should it have been on me to do that? So that was the first one, and obviously that's finished now, but it's taken nearly 9 years to do that, and we've had to go through a lot. I think the Richard Hall case, I think it came pretty quickly to the High Court, didn't it? But I think what's been frustrating is what's happened afterwards, because it's been nearly 2 years. So it was July 24 was the week trial. There was a summary judgment, and then the verdict was given in November 24. And then since then, he's appealed and exhausted all his appeals through the UK court. And we now have a bankruptcy hearing on the 8th of May in Cardiff. So potentially that could be 2 years since the trial. And then before that was obviously, you know, the 4 or 5 years of everything that he did and what all his followers did. So that's the frustrating bit, that you get the judgment and the verdict, but they can still then delay an appeal. And I do sometimes wonder, well, who's thinking about me and Eve in all of this? You know, where's our justice? But as my legal team and my friends and family know, the Hibberts don't give up. So we will win. And, you know, May the 8th will probably be, hopefully, the deciding day. You know, I've got all the time now, so, you know. Hopefully that'll be the end of it, but it is very frustrating. Once you get the verdict, you've done everything, but you then still have to get the legal team to chase everything else and the compensation and everything else. So it is very frustrating, but we get there in the end. Thank you
for your question. So if we can take the person in the middle in the brown jacket.
Hi, my name is Denise, and I'm an alum of LSE, specifically the School of Public Policy. Firstly, I wanted to thank all of you for being here tonight and sharing your stories. It's really inspiring, but also incredibly tragic. My question, I suppose, specifically are for the victims, or I suppose survivors. Knowing what you know now, on the other end of all of the things that you experience, what is one thing that you would do differently or tell yourself in the beginning in order to get through this experience, you know, with your head still on right?
Is it to Joel or to myself, that? Sorry.
All of you.
All right, okay. I think in terms of... I think a lot of what I've done, I've had to pursue it. So I think... Like Neil said, you know, with the arena, you know, I was, you know, as I started going through rehab and the drugs started to wear off and I started to be a bit more mindful of things. And as certain rhetorics were coming out from the police and the fire, I knew something wasn't right. And what I'd seen that night wasn't what was being said by the emergency services and the police and the fire. So I've had to, in everything that I've done, and with the Richard Hall thing, I've had to go and get the answers. And, you know, even at the start with the arena things, I was getting, you know, quite a lot of abuse from emergency services saying that, you know, how dare you say that what you're saying when they actually save your life. And obviously it wasn't then until the 3 reports came out from John Saunders where I thought, well, I can actually walk around now with my held eye because what I said is right. And actually, it was actually worse than what we'd actually thought, you know, in terms of, you know, what the emergency services hadn't done. You know, there's 3 reports there that everybody can read now about, you know, what wasn't done. And hopefully that will then change what happens again in the future. So I don't think I'd do anything differently. You know, I've had to go out and get the answers and get justice. I think with the Richard Hall case, it was only really when he started making it personal, when he went to video Eve where he crossed the white line. And again, anybody that knows me knows Eve's the most precious thing in my life. Once he did that, there was no turning back. So again, I had to do what I did for Eve, really. And again, hopefully on May the 8th, we you know, we can finally put that one to bed. So I don't think I'd do anything differently. I might just do it a bit quicker if I was to do it again. But no, I don't think I'd do anything differently. I'm quite proud of what I've done, and hopefully, you know, in the future, if Eve's Law comes out as well, there'll be protection for, you know, victims in the future as well. So watch this space.
I don't think I do anything differently, apart from I wouldn't be so stupid about computers and believe what they told me. I know a bit more about computers now, not a lot, but I do know it wasn't my fault, and I would have challenged maybe more. But as for fighting, you just need to get angry, and really angry at if you look around at what they'd done to other people, actually probably because they'd done it, they destroyed so many people, that just flicked a switch and made me so angry that, and I'm still angry because it's still not sorted out. But yeah, apart from that, apart from not believing in the beginning, I don't think I'd have done anything differently.
Thank you. So can we move to our online audience, please?
Hi, I'm interrupting this event to tell you about another awesome LSE podcast that we think you'd enjoy. LSE IQ asks social scientists and other experts to answer one intelligent question, like, why do people believe in conspiracy theories? Or, can we afford the super rich? Come check us out. Just search for LSE IQ wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to the event.
I've got many really good questions. It's difficult selecting. But so start with Charlotte Schroes, who says, I'm a victim turned campaigner and have been campaigning for 3 years. While this year successfully changed the law to ensure victims get free sentencing remarks in Crown Courts, much more to do on that. But I've had to sell my story, the intimate details, and tell the worst things to ensure coverage of my topic. How can we move away from this dramatization and clickbait headlines in the media? How can we move away from the horrendous headlines to grab attention?
Do you want me to answer that?
I mean, Charlotte didn't specify, but I think anyone...
Well, you know, I did I'm a Celebrity in 2003, and my own sister sold photographs of me to the tabloids. So she didn't bother to ask me. She sold family photographs. And I just think that in any situation, you can't really prevent that. Yet when a family is put in a spotlight, there's going to be someone in the family that only need money more than the others, and behave like that. I think that I don't think you're ever going to stop checkbook journalism ever. You can't see a way to stop it. The only way to stop it is when a newspaper comes offering you money for your story, that you just say no. I mean, I got married at the end of January, and my other marriages have been picked over endlessly by the tabloid press, and my choice of husbands have been pilloried, and perhaps rightly so in a couple of cases. And when I decided to get married for the fifth time, the registrar asked where my previous wedding certificate was, and I said I burnt it because it was such a mistake. But the fact is that I'd learned by then to own my own wedding. So I got married. I didn't tell anybody. I had two witnesses. I got married in Great Yarmouth, not the most fashionable place in Great Britain, on a Saturday morning with nobody there. And then I did a statement to the camera with my new husband and the dog, which I held on to, and I released to ITV on Monday morning. So I own my own wedding, so that's my answer to that. And I just did it for nothing, but to stop anybody else getting involved.
I wonder if I could just add a very brief word in response to Charlotte's question, because I think in some ways she puts her finger on an essential sort of tension in this field, which is the emotive is what gets attention.
Yes.
But it's also what is so dangerous and liable to abuse. So I think it's a good question, even though there isn't a good answer to it.
Yeah, there's no simple answer, because as I said at the start of my statement at the beginning, what newspapers are primary, they're commercial enterprises, that the press are trying to survive, and the only way they can survive is by telling stories, and to tell stories they need real people with real stories, and they need pictures and imagery, and how they acquire the ones that are different from their rivals is never going to be straightforward.
Thank you. Can we take a couple more from your mind?
Sure. So we have a question from Chris Patel, who's a journalist retraining as a lawyer. Mm-hmm. So Chris is asking anyone on the panel on their perspective will all be different. But he says, I imagine taking somebody to court for defamation is very expensive in terms of both money and energy. What are the best ways that lawyers can make clients feel supported throughout what can probably be quite a lonely process?
Thank you.
Yeah, defamation is not to be entered into lightly. It's beyond the pocket of most people. It's a field where if you're going to threaten it, you have to follow it through, because otherwise you lose teeth straight away. But it's a broader question, actually. When we talk about defamation, we talk about everything associated with victims' rights and affordability. And I think there are so many people that wouldn't be able to launch any form of redress unless there were lawyers willing to share that risk. And I think that's a real consideration. I think that people that have the luxury of being able to pursue rightful causes are very much in the minority. And I think that's all part of the conversation about, you know, victims' rights, and you know, as I said about, you know, victims being on the margins of everything, being a bit of an inconvenience, an afterthought, and funding to preserve and protect and promote those rights is clearly a concern, because I think you probably would think you were lucky in some senses to be able to not just us but other firms as well that have seen the damage that's been done, and have thought that, you know, we've got to help these people because nobody else is, the state isn't, you know, in fact they're going against that. So I think defamation is one example of a bigger issue around protecting and funding victims' rights so they get somewhere towards a balanced position in this whole process. I mean, I think I sort of slightly disagree with you about where victims sit. For me, victims should be front and centre. I think there are too many victims that are doing the job that the authorities should do. I can give you examples of that. Not in this room, but we were talking outside about Stephen Port Mark too, but Stephen Port is a great example of a family, two sisters, that wouldn't take no for an answer, that did their own detective work, and these are victims who did their own detective work, and their detective work led to the apprehension of a serial killer. Now, if they hadn't done that, where would they have been? And these, again, I say, are victims. So for me, victims and their loved ones and their families should be the front and centre.
It was in that particular case with Stephen Port, it was because the police thought that the victims were not worth anything, didn't they?
Well, they thought, and unfortunately history started to repeat itself. These are young gay men.
Yeah.
Go out, take GHB, get involved in these trysts and liaisons or whatever terminology you want to attach to it, take too much, they die. It's almost, you know, an occupational, recreational hazard attached to it. So they don't bother looking at what's in front of them. So they don't think it's, you know, it's remotely suspicious that a poor young man is dressed, parked up outside a flat, ran by some random bloke who says, you know, I found him in bed after I left him all day on his own after we'd only met the night before. They don't think it's suspicious that two victims are found by the same dog walker, sat in the same position in a churchyard. They don't think it's suspicious that another victim is found on the other side of the wall and would have been found by the same
But they were determined not to find it interesting. Well,
no, they weren't. They just did not. There's no professional curiosity.
Yeah.
There's no joining the dots. An officer will go do that, one will do that, one will do that. No one actually pulls it all together. But at the heart of that was prejudice. And as I say, it would be, you know, who knows where this would have ended up if we didn't have two sisters that were not taken. That was not my brother. My brother would not do that. They just went online and found these other victims. Yeah, it's just it's as horrendous as that. And we're in a position at the minute, as you and I were discussing, that we're engaged with another case at the minute where it's in the media, where the IOPC have just decided to relook at this. That, you know, it looks to some marks, as to some respects, as hallmarks of history repeating itself 10 years on. So it's obviously a deep worry and a concern.
Yeah.
And that opens up to kind of broader question about who's of interest to the media and the police, which is often an ideal victim. So we might think about the Stephen Lawrence case in relation to racist violence as being one of those cases which captured the media's attention because of very particular and very specific circumstances. But there's a very long history of cases long before Stephen Lawrence that weren't investigated. And, you know, that's part of a kind of broader question about justice for all kinds of victims who are not seen as ideal. I don't know if you wanted to add to that, Nikki.
No, I agree with that. And I also, you know, I very much take your point, Martin. I know you're right that there are, in many cases, it's the action of the victim's family that brings the thing to light. And I respect that, but I do have a reservation really about the thought that the victim should be front and centre, because that means that, you know, not all victims have the capacity to do that. And it introduces, I mean, I know that I'm speaking ideally, but it introduces kind of inevitable inequality into the criminal justice system. One thing we know from research on crime is that one thing about your chances of criminal victimisation, particularly your chances of repeat criminal victimisation, are correlated very, very strongly with other forms of social inequality, like being on the receiving end of racism, being poor, living in certain areas. And, you know, my worry is if we put too much onus in some way on the contribution of the victims, invaluable though that can be, and if I were a lawyer, I would be looking for that as well. But is that really how the system should be set up, with that expectation, knowing that many victims won't be in a position really to you know, be as agentic and effective as you all have?
It's a very interesting question, and a number of issues come out of it. And I suppose it's difficult. And in criminal proceedings, a defendant is innocent until proven guilty. And I suppose the courts are focused upon ascertaining that answer, whether or not they are guilty or innocent. And I had a case, I represented a journalist in a civil case which ran in tandem with criminal proceedings, and I had actually directed her towards the criminal justice process in the first instance because it was so severe, but she had never been a victim or involved in any types of litigation or court proceedings, and she was staggered by the experience of a victim in the criminal justice process. And in answer to the question that was asked online, whether it be defamation proceedings or any civil proceedings, they are costly, and litigation is not for the faint-hearted. And oftentimes, as Neil said, lawyers will share, you know, whether a mixture of pro bono or costs, risks, and really how involved a client is will depend on each client. Some clients drive it forward, no doubt, like Martin and Joe did, and others do not want to do that. They wish the lawyer to drive it forward for them. So it really is down to each person. But there's a lot of complex issues because clearly victims in the criminal justice process are front and centre and should always be in a crucial role, but it is difficult when one looks at what the institution of the courts and the rule of law is seeking to achieve in the criminal process.
Thank you. If we could take one more question, if we have one from online, and then we'll come back to finish in the room.
I suppose there's a... It's a short one, but I think that maybe goes to the heart of what we've been discussing. But it's an anonymous question, but the person asks, do you think the legal profession has forced people to resort to media to get justice because of the way they all are reluctant to recognise they are a profession that sometimes makes mistakes or because people can't afford it? So is justice just for the rich?
There is obviously an issue with access to justice. Justice is not just for the rich, but there is an access to justice issue which is getting worse. The role of the media is different to the legal process. They are distinct, but can obviously, they are a stakeholder within an ecosystem of the justice system. It is not either or, and it is not, not all litigation will benefit, nor will a party wish to be in the media. I mean, you know, the cases that I talked about there, that journalist was anonymised, certain parts of the proceedings had reporting restrictions in play, and she was not after, she was after justice in private, and she got that, but that's not always the case. But where there are matters of serious public interest, where perhaps the justice system has failed, as it did in Joe's case, we've seen the benefit of the media as a important stakeholder in the justice process, as well as the fourth estate in society.
I think as well there's an issue here about regulators not doing the job, so people are having to go to lawyers to seek some form of redress. So I think we've all got examples of some of the medical regulators, the regulators that oversee the police, not doing their job on and leaving people in a position where they've got to go beyond what is right and normal and where they should get some form of answer and redress. So I think that again, that feeds into the whole thing about the justice system, its resourcing. You talk about the court system waiting forever to get court dates, and that just gets worse. You know, public services so grossly underfunded that it all eventually links together.
We have time for, I think, two more questions, possibly three. So the person in the, I think, navy or black jumper in the middle.
What's the question? Yeah, my name is Peter. I failed my first degree in the University of Life, but never mind. My idea is that the biggest influence on the media is the rest of the media. In other words, that the whole media together is like one big cake of jelly. And it does seem as if truth is out of the question. It's a kind of a game between the different parts of the media. Well, that's just my idea. I don't know if you've got any thoughts about that yourselves.
Well, we all know from Meghan Markle, there's not one truth, there's my truth, your truth. We've all got a truth. I mean, 20 years ago, no one would have come up with such a preposterous idea. But that is definitely, I mean, I work in television. I'm surrounded by people talking about their truth. And we have a generation of extremely narcissistic people who record every aspect of their day, and they're the star of their scenario, and they're almost editing their own channel of their own life in their head, and that's their truth. So this, you know, the idea of one truth is, you know, is their truth is the most important.
Multiple truths. Anyone else want to respond to that?
Well, from a legal perspective, groupthink is dangerous for the media. And ultimately, whether you are a citizen journalist or a media outlet, you are responsible for the content you are publishing and disseminating. So groupthink won't save you. And there is no defence to repetition of a libel.
Yeah. Thank you. Two more questions. The person in green at the front.
Can we be optimistic, you know, with what's going on, you know, the distortion of truth that you're talking about, you know, highly egotistical politicians that, you know, can create alternative universes and so forth. But are you, some of you at least, optimistic, or is there more of the same to come?
Great question.
Well, we have to be optimistic, don't we? We take our lead from people here. You know, if they can, in the most horrific circumstances, be optimistic, you know, be driven. Us as lawyers, just feed off that, you know. That's the truth.
Yeah, I mean, I've met loads more good people than bad people. So I would say I'm optimistic that the good guys eventually will win, but we just have to shout a bit louder.
Yeah, I'd probably say the same. I think throughout the journey and throughout, you know, speaking with people, you know, certainly with the arena, we just wanted answers. You know, I've become friends with a lot of people that lost, you know, sons, daughters, mums, dads. You know, they just wanted the truth, and they wanted people to be held accountable. You know, it's taken 9 years to get those answers, and you know, maybe there'll be questions unanswered for forever, but I'm at peace with that now. And I think whenever I do something, I always want lessons to be learned and some good to have come from it. So that's why, especially with the what's happened with the arena and with the Richard Hall case, I can't really go into too much detail at the minute, but it's why Eve's Law is very important, because it'll protect people going forward. But into answering one of those questions about access to justice, that's what I want Eve's Law to be about as well. It's not just about to protect victims, it's about giving victims the chance to get their voices heard and their stories told. I think that's so important. So watch this space on Eve's Law. We're currently going through things at the minute, and we hope to get it out in the future. But you know, that hopefully that's going to be one of the things to come from the good to come from the Richard Hall case, is that people don't have to go through that again in the future, and there'll be a law in place to protect victims going forward. So watch this space. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Janet, I don't know if you'd like to respond. You showed signs of being somewhat pessimistic, I think, as a media insider, but
no,
I might have read that wrong.
I'm completely addicted to news. I watch the news every night. Even though I worked at the BBC as a top executive for 10 years, and so I'm fascinated by the fact the BBC is always in the doghouse, the BBC is always shit, the person who's in charge of it is always seen as incompetent. And I'm reading a book called Dianorama, which is an investigative journalist book that looks at the whole Martin Bashir story and what happened afterwards, and how the big BBC cover-up. But what I have to say is I'm an optimist. I'm an optimist that the BBC will survive, and I'm an optimist that people will still have a hunger for news. Obviously, at the moment, what depresses me, that I'm surrounded by people, like people saying on the news or on the TV, oh, I hate politics, they're all a bunch of shits and blah, blah, blah. The big turn off politics. But even worse, people say, I don't want to watch the news, it's so miserable. News is news, and I think news is a reflection of the world that you live in, and if you say that you're not interested in news, that shows that you're going even more inward-looking and that you're shunning the world around you. I personally think that for a healthy society, you must have a healthy new interest in what other people are doing, and that is news. So I'm an optimist.
Thank you. So we've kind of run out of time, I'm afraid. I'd like to thank everybody, the audience, both here and online, and especially to thank our panellists and to very much appreciate the humbling experiences that you've shared and your willingness to come into a public place and talk about very personal things that have happened to you. So thank you very much for sharing your stories and also that you are still optimistic.
Listening. You can subscribe to the LSE Events podcast on your favorite podcast app and help other listeners discover us by leaving a review. Visit lse.ac.uk/events to find out what's on next. We hope you join us at another LSE event soon.